2%.
The 2%'s right over here.
Oh, hey, Jenna. I didn't know you shopped here.
Yeah. Anything to support local food. Know what I mean?
I definitely do. Though that's not the only thing you do in the name of Good Eats, obviously.
Well, true. I also host Eating Matters every Wednesday at 5 p.m., where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. Be sure to tune in.
All right, gotta get the plug in there. I get it.
Yep, I'm hashtag shameless.
You know what else you can do to support the local food community, right?
Well, yeah. Make a donation to Heritage Radio Network, the world's pioneer food radio station.
That's right. And I gotta call you out on the whole local thing.
What do you mean?
Well, The Farm Report, A Taste of the Past, Japan Eats. Those are shows that take you around the country and the world.
I'll give you that. So how can listeners give their support?
It's pretty easy. Just go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the big red heart in the top right corner. It's pretty easy from there.
Thanks.
Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Jerobi from A Tribe Called Quest / Eats Rhymes in Life, and you're here listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome to The Main Course without Patrick Martins. We are broadcasting on heritageradionetwork.org. I am with the charming and knowledgeable Philip Gilmore.
That's me.
Hi, Philip.
That was neat in the neat intros. We had Cane Winery and Jerobi from Tribe Called
Quest. It is foreshadowing.
Yes. We're associated with the best people in the world.
We have in studio today, very exciting, we have Jermaine Stone.
Yes, yes. How you doing?
We also have Julia Gilbert.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, thank you guys for coming on.
Of the upcoming show, the Gilbert and Stone Wine Hour.
I think you're changing their name without any consent.
No, what's the name of the podcast you're doing?
Taste the World. We're doing the Taste the World podcast.
Taste the World with Gilbert and Stone.
Yeah, I like that. It has a great ring to it.
It does. It actually sounds like a winery.
It feels right. Yes. Yeah, no, that's what we should do.
Gilbert and Stone of Mount
Gilbert and Stone Winery.
Yeah.
Yes. It's done. I'm putting it out there.
Can it be winery spelled like W-H-I-N-E? It's like plain the entire time.
Try our Cabernet.
Yeah, no, I'm with it. I'm going to talk. I need to convince Julia on it a little bit more, yeah. But I feel like she's influenced me so much on what I should drink that it would just be natural to go down that path together.
Drink your own wine.
Exactly.
Is that how that works? It's two-way street. You guys influence each other on wine.
Absolutely.
Choices?
Jermaine and I have known each other, 11 years now, and yeah. We sort of always had a symbiotic relationship where he influences everything I listen to from the very beginning. He's been making what are called JG mixes for me.
Classics.
And on the flip side, I tell him what to eat, what to drink, all that.
Yeah.
So.
11 years ago isn't long enough ago to him having made you a mixtape, right?
They were mixed CDs at that point.
Yeah.
And, I've now transitioned over to emailing her just a link to a playlist.
Man, I remember the good old days of just handing people, a 1,000 MP3s on a CD. Yeah.
Exactly.
Did you spend time on the cover art or like sharpieing the...
No, we'd name them. Actually, I worked for a bar like 13 years ago, and it was kind of an interesting thing. We had all the bartenders were responsible for making mix CDs. But the concept is it could never have a theme. It could never be the same genre of music or the same artist once on each CD. So you had to mix it. And so we would have a big spindle of or whatever they are. And so it was like, probably 200 CDs and you have to take the top one. And so it's just this random everybody's mixes all together. So that's kind of fun. So you'd come up, with funny little names for them all. But So you said you watched Stranger Things on Netflix?
I took your advice. Well, it was less advice and more like strong urging.
Yes.
You were like, twisting
ever.
My arm on Friday.
Best
it was
show
really
ever.
Good. Yeah. It's creepy.
You don't even it gets like the first two episodes are just so you're getting to know the characters. By episode 7 it goes deep.
I'm chicken baby. I can't watch things that are not meant to be scary, like, freak me out.
I didn't really find it scary, though. It really says it's scary, but I guess it's kind of creepy.
It's not. I don't think it's scary. I think it is creepy. You described it as, like, mashup Donnie Darko.
E.T., definitely.
E.T.
Akira. Have you guys seen Akira?
No, I've never seen Akira.
It's the Japanese anime, probably the best, you know, animated film of all time. But, you know, even the opening scene when the kids are, you know, in the cure, there's a little kid that escapes the hospital and they has a tattoo on the arm, shaved head, hospital clothes. So same thing as that show. But I love it because it's like it's borrowing, not stealing, you know?
Yeah.
Like even the opening scene is like, you know, four kids playing Dungeons and Dragons in 1983, eating pizza in the basement, E.T. You know, that's right, like just straight up, you know, borrowing, not stealing. Yeah.
And it's Winona Ryder, right?
Winona Ryder. I think Winona Ryder is the only actor, actress that I know in the whole show.
The kids are fantastic in it. The kid actors.
They're so great. They're all freaky looking. Yeah.
You guys haven't seen it yet?
No. Not yet. But I keep hearing about it.
Mm.
I find a hard time, like, talking and watching television in New York. I don't really find time to get into series. I'm like,
I'm very careful with it. Like, I'm very, because, you know, if you, because it's like they're all good.
Right.
You know, they're all addicting. So it's just, I'm very careful with
it. I do one at a time.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
There was a point I was like really into The Affair at one point, and I couldn't watch Homeland at the same time as The Affair. I had to just do it one at a time. And, you know, who has that kind of stuff? Takes me like 2 months to get through like one series. But
I start a lot, and like Homeland, what else? Daredevil. A lot of these shows, like, they have to be absolutely perfect. If I lose interest, I just kill it.
Yeah, exactly.
Like I got like 2.5 seasons of Homeland. I'm like, yeah, I don't care if everyone dies. Yeah. Fuck them.
There was one I did do a straight binge watch on Peaky Blinders. I don't know if you ever
Peaky Blinders has.
I ran through 2 seasons in like 48 hours.
Yeah.
It was
Have you seen the new season?
Yeah.
So good.
I got kind of lost in episode 2. I'm like not.
Well, you know what the trick with Peaky Blinders is? You have to put on the closed caption.
Yeah.
Yes. And I'm such a creature of like doing a crossword puzzle while I'm watching TV or something. Yeah. You can't do that. You have to pay full attention to Peaky Blinders. And I'm so bad with history that I'm like, the Russians, the Bolsheviks, like, what is happening? Like, I'm lost.
Yeah, I think Ounce for Ounce, too, Tom Hardy is my favorite actor
he crushed
ever.
That.
He's coming back. Yeah.
He crushed that. I mean, he killed season 3 also. Yeah. Like, his performance in season... I didn't think he could get better than what he did in season 2 when season 3 was...
Don't you mean he got killed in season... Oh, no!
No spoilers. No spoilers.
Which one is Tom Hardy?
Did you watch Peaky Blinders?
Yeah. I like Cillian Murphy.
Did you see season 3?
No. Okay. We're on
He's
season 2.
He's the baker. Right. The, like, not baker, baker.
The Russian...
Oh.
The Russian-Jewish baker guy.
Yeah. He just came in. Yeah. Well, I mean, where I am in the series.
Yeah.
Obviously.
It's introduced. It was definitely an addiction for a little while. Season 3 kind of lost me, though. I was a little disappointed. I can't say why. Phil knows why.
Yeah.
But
I forgot the end. Yeah.
You know, that is rules, man.
But hey, how can I say
rules?
This? Okay, I'm gonna say.
Is this anything like The Wire? The demise of Omar. There are rules.
Yeah.
I'm gonna say something without spoiler alert for you guys. But I think that Thomas Shelby always has a plan that's the best for his family, even though that his family doesn't understand it.
Right.
Some Godfather shit. So I'd like to think, without spoiler alert, that's what I think.
Right,
it is.
Right. Okay. All
you
right.
know what I keep thinking about talking about TV shows? Have you guys ever heard jumping the shark, the phrase?
Of course.
Yeah. You know where it's from, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, from... Yeah, have you heard the term jumping the shark?
Yes.
It's when like somebody or something just, you know, goes so far that it just sucks.
Yeah.
But it actually comes from Happy Days. The second season of Happy Days is the most watched show of all time, and there's a thing where Fonzie jumps over these buses and crashes. That's the second season. And it was like the most watched TV show of all time because, like, did Fonzie die? And then like eight seasons later, they tried to bring back the magic of Fonzie jumping
the
buses.
Well, the series was like on
the demise. Yeah.
Decline.
They'd already brought in Mork, the alien. And so the last episode of the last season, Fonzie, instead of jumping buses, he's actually on water skis and a leather jacket and shorts, and he's jumping over shark tank in a lake in Minneapolis or Wisconsin or wherever they're from. So that's when his show goes to where, like, you know, they're trying too hard. They call it jumping the shark. Yeah. But he's wearing shorts and a leather jacket. Yeah,
I can see that.
Mm-mm. Who was that? That was the director that just passed away.
Who?
Gary Marshall?
Yeah.
I was going to say, I want to say George Miller. That's not it. So
Penny Marshall's dad.
Is that really her father?
I believe so.
I love Penny Marshall.
Yeah, because what's his name? Rob Reiner, Carl Reiner.
Yeah.
Marshall, Reiner. And they dated or married.
And he played
Penny Marshall.
Really?
Power couple, yeah.
Gary Marshall played like the chocolate guy in Harvey in League of Their Own.
Yep, exactly.
Is that a good enough? No, I've seen it a lot. Many times.
I like the League of Their Own. You know, it's my jam.
So do you guys ever do?
You just like Madonna. you just like lesbian softball teams and baseball teams and Madonna. You didn't like a League of Their Own.
That is a strong preference.
You know what? I appreciated to see some strong women doing what they wanted to do. You know, I like that. I thought
Kit,
it was pretty cool.
Kit up there behind home plate.
Kit, who's now on Orange is
You
the
are
Black.
A closet Tom Hanks fan. Admit it, sir.
I mean, aren't we all?
Oh, yeah.
Aren't we all?
So do you guys ever do strategic wine pairings with anything like video or music? Or have you ever considered that?
Oh, yeah. All day. I'm a guy that's driven by mood, you know. I gotta set the mood for everything. So if I'm setting the mood for a good night at home, maybe I have some space, you know. I'm going to go mid-90s white burgundy and, you know, some the right kind of pizza, the right kind of movie. Like, for me, that's how I unwind, definitely.
I like that concept of pairing to mood.
Do you know what? Isn't it Mike Edison that did the Led Zeppelin thing?
Yeah. Him and Joe Bastianich.
Yeah, but Joe Bastianich, you have the whole, you know, Del Posto, whatever empire. They did these Led Zeppelin. Was it at Del Posto?
Or
where was it?
No. Josh, you can speak.
What?
I feel like nobody can hear me. No, it wasn't at Del Posto. I think it might have been in Italy somewhere.
Wherever the venue
I thought it was in New York, no?
The venue was whatever, but it was like a, I think a live band
doing
plus
Led Zeppelin.
Mike Edison, Arts and Seizures host on the theremin, like wah, wah, and then pairing Led Zeppelin songs with wines.
Yeah.
And that it was like a dinner, like buy a ticket, you know, fancy dinner.
Yeah, like see, I would pair, you know, I like midnight. I would go 96. White Berg with some 96 Reasonable Doubt vintage Jay-Z, right? You know? Like, nice. great things happened that year.
Do you ever take a wine that you hate and play it with music you hate just to see what happens? Kind of like a pain experiment, you know?
Listen, you know what? I'm free Friday.
I like what's it called? Like Mondavi White Zinfandel with a
Rick Astley.
Yeah.
Speaking of white burgundies, I fucking love white burgundies. They're my favorite. You know what I'm obsessed with? That they're hard to find. I mean, as far as like small wine shops and restaurants are like white Rhones.
Right.
I love, like, you know, Chateau Neuf de Pop Whites or whatever, too.
Right, so you like some, like, heady tropical stuff.
Yeah. I am from Florida.
I'm pineapple in your wine.
Yeah, I'm actually, like, a heady tropical guy. Like, I don't wear socks ever.
Our logo is two little pineapples.
Yeah. I like the logo. Is that what it's influenced by?
Yeah, it was influenced by, you know, in 94, Chateau Beaucastel, Chateau Neuf de Pop White. That's where the pineapple came from. No, just kidding.
I assume.
I believe you.
So let's talk about how did you guys both get into wine?
Mm. similar but different stories. You know, we actually both started at the same place at Zachy's.
You guys were 12 and you discovered a secret cave in the forest that had a wine cellar.
Yeah, it was a bright light beneath a cracked door, and I just walked over. Yeah. I was in college. I needed a job, and I was.
Where are you from, though?
I'm from the Bronx.
Bronx, okay.
Yeah, I'm from the Bronx.
That's near Connecticut, right?
Yes. Yeah, it's a little 30-minute drive. Yeah. Pretty similar neighborhoods.
Yeah. What part of the Bronx?
I'm from the northeast section, so I always tell people everywhere between 241st and Gun Hill Road. Yeah. Everywhere between there, that's where I'm from.
And how about you? Where are you from?
I grew up in Charlotte.
North Carolina? Cool. Mm-hmm. Cool.
Right. Pretty different from the.
So, where did you go to college?
Yeah, I went to Monroe, start in New Rochelle. Mm-hmm. I was one of those kids. I graduated high school and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And my mom was like forcing me to go to college and kind of just to get her off my back. I was like, okay, I'll apply and went and signed up and did it. Yeah. You know, but it wasn't in my plan at that time. I was focused on different things,
sex and drugs.
Yeah, not that explicitly, but I wasn't focused on school at that time, and
alcohol, sex and drugs. Yeah, sorry, left that out.
More well rounded.
Yeah. So once I got into school, I immediately did well, and. I said, okay, well, I should probably pay for this. And, you know, it's just probably getting pretty expensive. I had a lot of brothers and sisters. So I started working in a wine storage facility, which was a sister company of the auction house I ended up working with. And just a guy in the shipping department.
It was just like a receiving and shipping place, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. With wine, it needs to be stored at the correct temperatures to be preserved. Over a long time, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, they have these awesome storage facilities, which
So when it's 100 out, it's not 100 inside. When it's 0 out, it's 0 inside.
Exactly. So, even that was like a foreign thing to me. I was like, why would people pay for wine storage? So I learned everything.
Why would people pay $30,000 electric bill to?
I didn't get it at that time. And so everything was, my entire wine base was from on the job learning.
Yeah. Was it mostly French or?
No, it was everything. I mean, I guess different times for different seasons. There was one point when I was first introduced to wine, Bordeaux was like super.
And how long ago is this?
This was now 13 years ago.
13 years ago. So yeah. 90 years, 2003.
Yeah. 2003 is when I started at Zachy's and then moved on to.
And did they have a retail store as well?
Yeah.
Yeah. What's it called?
Zachy's.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Well, that was the start. Ended up at Wally's, which was. it's a Los Angeles based retailer. Mm-hmm. And they opened an auction house, and the rest is history.
Yeah.
When did you first start drinking wine?
Really. I'd hate to say when I started because I was only 19, but I started at the beginning of my career. So as soon as I turned 20,
I mean, it was part of the culture of.
Yeah, yeah. Drinking when we worked, working at auctions, and mind you, let me just step back. I started as an office administrator. I didn't come in as a specialist or anything like that. But, you know, I was around wine all day and I wanted to learn more and more about it. So when there were tastings in the office, people like Julia would introduce me to awesome wines that they were tasting.
Julia, how did you get started with Zaki? Did you set out to have a career in wine?
No, I also stumbled on it in a not dissimilar way from Jermaine. I was in college studying Latin and Italian and didn't want to teach, so didn't really have any useful skills. I probably still don't really have any useful skills. And, you know, I started drinking wine. My parents, a little bit growing up in high school, would enjoy wine, but I think a lot of other people started drinking wine in college, not good wine, and probably very bad wine. Right. But then I spent a lot of time in Italy while I was studying, and that really changed things for me because it's so much more of a sociological thing there where, you know, it's grown 100 meters away and it's evolved to match the octopus that they just caught from the sea.
Where in Italy were you?
I lived in Venice for a semester and spent a summer in Rome before that. But it was actually kind of an experience in Sicily where when I was traveling that just kind of opened my mind, where I realized that it's very different and it's kind of particular to Italy, but they really have evolved the wine and the winemaking and the grapes over the years to match the food. And there's some areas of France where they can do that. Obviously, I don't think in Napa they're like evolving wines to match Napa cuisine. So that was kind of a light went off in my head, and I thought, okay, this is more than getting drunk with my college friends on magnums of Yellowtail. This is something very different. So I started to appreciate it then. And when I got back to the U.S., I worked at a wine shop in college. We sold handles of vodka. It was not really a wine shop, you know. But when I graduated, I again had no skills and thought wine would be cool. I knew I wanted to be in the city, and happened upon a job listing on Craigslist for an assistant job at a wine auction house. And I thought, well, okay, I know a little tiny bit about wine. That seems cool. And then the rest was history. So just like Jermaine, I came in knowing basically nothing, learned everything on the job. But it was a really, Zaki's was a great experience for both of us. I was there for 8 years. You were there for 10 years.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, we both have really great wine knowledge, but, we started from similar levels.
Right. That's cool. It was the kind of place. It was just like, honestly, that was what, you know, prior to working at Zaki's, you looked at wine as this thing of, you know, this high prestige, and, you know, you're not allowed to drink it or whatever. You know, I'd hear like Frasier talking about it. Like that was about it, right? And I didn't feel like I related to Frasier. But when I started working at Zaki's, I met people like Julia, people like my friend Michael Jessen, you know, just regular people that spoke about wine in an everyday conversation way. And that was how I learned about it. So, it was a great atmosphere for that sort of thing.
What's the role of an auction house in the larger wine world and wine distribution circle? Like who is bidding on these wines? Is it private collectors?
it's interesting. It's a tiny niche. It's a tiny, tiny niche, the auction industry. And the people who are really players in it, who are selling wine and buying wine on the global auction market, is in like the low, low thousands. Like there are not very many clients who are buying and selling wines of this caliber. It tends to be fine and rare. It usually, the vast majority of it, I would say, is older wines that are no longer available on the market. So you can't just walk into your wine shop and find a bottle of 1982 Lafite. I mean, you can, but not. It's rare.
Not at what it costs at auction.
Right. When I was 17, I mean, my friend got in big trouble. His parents had like a serious wine collection. Like you know, they lived in a giant house, but they actually had a safe door, like an old Wells Fargo safe door, and a wine room about the size of this room. And they were gone, and we knew the combination. And this is going to make you guys cringe, but we actually drank, I don't remember the exact year, but like vintage Dom Perignon from like the late 60s or early 70s. And we drank two bottles. And we just said, oh, it's Dom Perignon. We didn't even look at the fucking year.
Right.
Like it wasn't like.
You guys went into a locked safe door. What did you think you were going to be drinking?
Dom Perignon, because it's Dom Perignon.
Like that's what you keep.
But his mom, like, you know, she's like, do you realize you basically affected the entire world market price for this champagne? Like, you really realize that.
What did it taste like? That's what I wanted to know. What did you think about it?
I pretended that I liked it because I had no idea what I was drinking. It's like, you know, it was like seriously, like the same as like a $5 bottle of champagne.
isn't the ratio 10% of wine is corked? Some told me that, like, anything aged, like, you're like 7 to 10% of like all wine.
What do you
laid
think,
down and corked?
I haven't heard that statistic.
I'm not confident in quoting something like that. I mean, there is definitely a high high number of bottles that are corked, and that's why they're switching to screw caps for basically anything that isn't meant to age more than a couple of years. They put in screw caps because you can't have corked wine with a screw cap. It really is something that lives in the cork
or the plastic corks.
Right.
Yeah. It's just so interesting that like. Well, now they also have that the
Coravin, right?
The mosquito needle.
Yeah, the Coravin.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, it's like this like super thin needle goes through the cork and can sample the wine without introducing atmosphere to the bottle.
Right.
That has got to really fuck with pricing.
Well, it's really great. Restaurants use it really well because that way, if you want to sell a taste of a really expensive bottle for $200, in Vegas, maybe have tastes of special wines for $250 or $1,000 a pop. You can do that without, if one person wants a glass, you can give that to them without the whole bottle being toast. They can last for months and months, the bottles that they use that for. It's dangerous because it's also being introduced as a way to counterfeit wines. Like maybe, somebody has a really special, comes upon a great old bottle and they want to drink it, but not impact the cork or the capsule. They could extract it, drink it, enjoy it, and fill it back up with something else and sell it. And it's hard to detect. Like the auction houses, where the resale market is becoming more attuned to you can see it. I mean, you can see a little bit of a pinhole where it goes through. But while it's really great for certain things, it's a little dangerous too.
Has it come into the auction world that people are like testing wines now? Because before it was almost like you're auctioning, like it's a crapshoot. Like you're buying a bottle, but like you can never know what the contents were like before. Is it a required step for buyers?
Well, not extracting. I don't think anybody's ever sold a bottle that they extracted wine from to taste. But for the auction houses, due diligence is knowing the story of the wines, where they came from, and sampling wines. So for every collection that comes across at auction, the house should have sampled extensively from it to make sure that...
And also lineage, like, it's like, like a tracing a Picasso painting, like, it was owned by this people for 20 years.
Right.
And then those people bought it from these people for 20 years, and then that was the year it was made.
Right.
So that, like, the more the paperwork is,
Establishing the provenance, right.
So, and if you look at, if you look at most auction catalogs today, you'll notice that they highlight the consignor a lot of the time before they talk about the consignment, because you might be buying a particular bottle, but you might see that same bottle later on in the catalog. What would make you bid on this one over that one?
Oh, and also too, how it was stored.
Right.
Like, did you buy this 82 Lafitte from an individual, and who knows how many times they moved and what kind of fucked up condition is this? Or was it sitting in a storage facility for the last 25 years?
And that's especially where the screening comes into play, because if people can have receipts and they can tell you stories about their grandparents or whatever, but that's really the conditions can only be told once you open the bottle.
What is the lowest price that you've seen a bottle of wine go at auction? Because of course I'm going to ask you what's the highest price. What's the lowest price you've been at an auction house?
I like where you're going with it. And
what's the lowest price that you've seen at auction?
A beautiful misconception that we can shut down right now is that they only sell expensive wine at auctions.
No.
You can get some great deals. Like you go to an online auction, you might buy some bottles for like $30.
Mm-hmm.
But with live auctions, the average lot value is usually a lot higher.
Yeah.
So for the most part, everything's going to be in the thousands. But if you stick around long enough, and if you search that catalog long enough, you can find some things for like $100, $80 sometimes.
That are worth probably $500 or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, that'll pop up somewhere else for that price.
Okay, so what is the most expensive wine? Single one wine, what's the most expensive you've seen?
Mm.
There was a pretty special auction, and I actually.
God,
I'm not
please
sure
don't say
it.
Screaming eagle.
No,
please.
No.
Whispering angel. Yeah.
There was.
Do you know Screaming Eagle?
No.
Oh, it's yeah. It's like a brand new winery, and they're like it's like $30,000 for one bottle.
The Pappy Van Winkle. Of
mm-hmm, exactly.
It's yeah. Screaming Eagle is considered sort of the best, most exclusive, finest, and rarest California wine.
Yeah. Is it Cab Sauv?
Yep.
It is. Mm-hmm. We, in 2007, I want to say, I can't even remember, when we were at Zaki's, a really special collection was sold of a fellow named Nils Stormby, who was Swedish.
Oh, yeah.
And he had a real taste for sweet wines, for Sauternes. So he had a really amazing collection of Chateau de Kim. And
yeah, I love it so much.
The sort of, it got a lot of press. It was a pretty special collection. A few things went totally gangbusters. And we sold one Magnum for $150,000.
Yeah. Wow. I didn't even know they had Magnums.
That was before the VIG. Ended up being more than that, about 20% more than that.
Year was it, do you know?
Ooh,
probably
was it 21?
I was gonna say 20s, right?
Maybe 45. I can't remember. And actually, I was. This is sad because I was the person. It was a phone bidder, and I was the person, the proxy in the room bidding on it for the client. So I really
should
know
this. Do you get nervous at all, like when you're raising your hand for someone else, because you're still raising your hand for $100,000?
There's ice in her veins. Yeah. She's like Steph Curry with the
no,
shot.
No, I mean it is shopping with someone else's money. It's really fun to sit in that room and be like, yeah, $100,000.
But then you do the cliche like stockbroker movie thing where like, you know, as soon as they the you know, $150,000, and then you go, okay, we'll call you tomorrow, and you go.
Like slapping fives all over the place.
No, just punch in the air like you buy yourself.
No, I actually just probably like turn red and blush and hope that people aren't looking at me. But
I actually just spent $30,000 of someone else's money and it felt great.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's like this is fun. Exactly. Just put it in my shopping cart. Bye. We should take a break real quick, and then we'll get back to talking more about wine.
Yeah, man.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
welcome back to the main course. I'm Alexis McLaughlin, Philip Gilmore, and we're still talking with Julia Gilbert and Jermaine Stone. So we were just talking about the whole world of the wine auction houses, but I would love to talk a little bit more about what you guys are getting into now, and especially the podcast, because I like the idea you're saying about just, you know, introducing new ways to talk about wine, or just like, you know, simplifying it.
Right. Yeah. So our show is called Taste the World Podcast, and really, it's a collective of several different personalities, like just a group of us that get along well together, and we're very opinionated on tastes, right? And that could be your taste in several different things. It could be your taste in music, your taste in movies, your taste in television, but wine is a common theme between all of us. So the conversation always starts with wine, and it goes into other things. So, you know, in the vein of spreading the knowledge and helping there to be more people that you can enjoy wine with, we mix in cultural figures. We did a podcast with, I know Phil loves old school hip hop. We had Lil C's from Junior Mafia on the show, and we were teaching him about appreciating Riesling. So that's on the first show. But we just brought him in like he was one of our friends, and started talking about it with an importer that also loves hip hop. So it just brings in the commonality of wine.
Yeah, and bringing in the sort of the wine amateurs helps, because C's, without prompting, sort of said, am I holding the glass right? Why are you holding the glass with the stem and not with the bowl? And how do you swirl it? You know, he asks a really good question. So I think that it's really helpful for imparting a little, breaking down the intimidation and imparting some knowledge to have people who really know nothing and have them asking genuine questions that the audience might have too.
At some point we were all in that place.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're hearing someone that you, like Lil C's, that you looked up to in that same place, you're not going to feel weird about asking those questions. It's just, we all start there. Like, Julia was there, I was there.
And part of the reason that we're doing this is Jermaine and I, as we said, got into the business at, like, 19. I was 22. And we had a really unique experience of being thrown headfirst immediately into the really fine and rare world, but we realized that, I mean, we're totally normal people and relatable people, I think. So we realized that there is a way to access it without it being super intimidating and a language that people don't understand.
Right.
You're really taking me back. This is like literally 22 years ago, more. Anyways, I was actually working like fine dining restaurants, and I kind of snuck in. Like, I was working in regular restaurants, and then I kind of lied on my resume and snuck into like fine dining restaurants in Palm Beach. But I was like, you know, selling these wines that I'd never tasted. Like, literally, like, you have a fucking stupid 23-year-old kid that's opening up a 64 Margaux. Like, mm-hmm. No lie. Seriously. Mm-hmm. No idea what I'm doing. No idea about wine. But I actually, as a favor to an owner, I did a wine tasting, a wine pouring with Kevin Zeraley. Mm-hmm. And he gave me his book, The 5-Minute Wine Expert. Right. And tasting those wines, I remember what it was. It was it was 11 Italian winemakers, all Italian, and the actual winemakers there doing like a 3-hour, you know, Italian wine tasting, and listening to him speak, him giving me the book, me tasting those wines, all those 11 amazing, you know, Chiantis and Barolos and, you know, all those things, like, really taught me, like, oh, that shit that I'm opening and pouring. I was just looking at it as, like, you know, the place I worked at, it's an automatic 20% gratuity because it's, like, a private dining club.
Right.
And I was just looking at it like, no, that's a great wine. Oh, my God, this is my favorite because it's $800, not because I know what the fuck I'm talking about.
Right.
So I kind of, like, you know, that's made me really kind of sound similar to you guys. You know, you're just like, you know, oh, here's a $10,000 box of wine right up there, you know. Yeah. You know, like, so, yeah. Like, you know, it really kind of, like, got a taste for it after then.
Yeah. No, it throwing that stuff around definitely made me want to drink it more. <It's true.
laughs> Was it a curiosity for what does everyone else see, or?
Yeah, you know, if I was watching people spend hundreds of and thousands of dollars on, you know, a couple different bottles.
Grape juice.
You know, so I I appreciate good taste, so I wanted to know what they tasted. And the more I looked at that, the more I could look at something else I was in love with similarly, like music. Why do I like music? I would talk to other people and say, okay, what is it about this song that you like? So when you're doing a wine tasting, really that's all, what flavors are you experiencing? It's the same thing.
Yeah.
So just understanding how to approach each flavor and, be distinctive about what you're experiencing.
Well, and we were saying, as we were talking about before the show, I mean, it is as simple as starting out with, do you like this, yes or no, and why? I mean, it's that simple. That's how you taste wine.
Right.
And I think that it is really intimidating to people to get in and say, well, I can't identify the strawberry and the tannin and the acid, and holy cow, this is really intimidating. But everybody can really just start from, do you like this? Yes or no? And if you say yes, maybe we can figure out why, and we can steer you towards similar things at different price points or whatever. But it starts out with, do you like it? Yes or no? Yeah.
At least be a more educated customer, I feel like I come from a place where you thought about the brand first. Like, I'm drinking Hennessy, not I'm drinking cognac. And, if you thought about it in the place of I'm drinking cognac, then you'll try different types of cognac. And what is it about this Hennessy that I like? Can I pick out these flavors? And you can, with wine specifically, it's so regional, wine from this part of the world usually tastes like this. So we try to help people be better consumers on our show.
You know what a big thing for me is, and I've never gotten over it, there's certain wines, I won't even pick and say which ones, but there's certain wines that I hate in my mind because of the label. Like, packaging is such big thing. There's certain fonts or certain images or super color combinations that I will never buy this wine ever because I hate it.
Wine purchases or spirit purchases where I'm like, oh, this looks like a cool bottle.
Yeah.
I think I'll try.
I'm on the fence about Heights, Is it Heights? Heights Cellars or whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes I look at it and I hate the label, and sometimes I love the label.
The old school with, like, the colors. Yeah.
And then also, like, don't they have, like, that weird, like, kind of Germanish-looking font?
Yes.
Yeah, like the
Well,
fuck them.
Try a few different.
No, I've had it before.
Well, we'll invite you to the next time we do a tasting.
Awesome.
And we'll show you. We'll introduce you to some vintages which you're going to love.
Now, like, okay, so name your favorite wine you've ever had. Do you have to have one time when you had one wine that, like, I think that this is the best wine I've ever had, or no? Do you have a time and a place or memory?
It's usually for me more than the time and the place. I mean, I have been really fortunate, Jermaine has too, to have what are categorically considered the best wines in the world over the years. But it's always experiential. Mm. If you taste that in a lab-like environment, in a totally sterile environment where you're not with people you love or drinking food or listening to music that you love, it's going to be a totally different experience.
Yeah, right.
So for me, I probably could name experiences more than the actual wines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's the oldest wine you've ever tried? Have you ever tried any pre-1900s?
Yes. Ooh. I definitely have Madeira, Port's Madeiras from like 1860s, wow. I think is probably the oldest. Those are wines that are fortified wines that are made to last forever.
Yeah. What about wine? Have you ever had?
I've certainly had wine from the very early 20th century.
Any good?
Sure.
I've had a 21 Ecam. We've had that a few times.
Right, again,
a few times.
Fortified, so that's like
built
to last.
Because of the sugar content?
Right.
Right. I mean, to say good, it's not going to taste like the current vintage of the same wine.
Yeah.
But there are certain aspects of the flavor profile of the terroir, of the structure of the wine, the acidity, the tannin that can last and be reminiscent. I mean, certainly we've opened plenty of old bottles that are just vinegar. That happens.
Yeah.
But if they have been well preserved and the cork has held up, there's a chance that they actually can retain some of the, like, amazing, just romantic, incredible aspects of what they were, you know, 80 years ago.
That's why it's important to hire good logistics people. I'm just saying.
you know what a sommelier a long time ago pointed out to me? I was talking, we had a couple wines on the menu at the restaurant that we worked at. I think the oldest one was a 28 Lafitte, but we had 64 Margaux and all these really big, huge wines. And actually, the sister restaurant of the restaurant I worked at actually had, I think, I want to say an 1880 Margaux or somewhere. Anyway, some of these bottles are $10,000, $12,000. And I was talking to him about, kind of same question, what's the oldest wine you had? And he made the whole point, a 64 Margaux, to really appreciate what you're tasting, you would have to have a 66 Margaux and a 1972 Margaux and an 82 Margaux. You would have to taste it today and everyone backwards in time to really know what you're tasting, especially if it's, something from the 20s or something from the, that it is kind of a little bit wag the dog. People are just, ordering because it's the most expensive bottle, yeah. But they don't even know what they're drinking unless they're wine experts,
right.
So they should be, people should be banned. There should be a quiz before you order, before you order a 64 Margaux. Can you answer a few questions, please?
No, if I go favorite wine, I'd probably go 85 Krug.
That's a good one.
That matched a great experience.
That's a bubbly wine?
Yeah, no, it's a little...
I think they call it sparkling wine.
Yeah, sparkling. Well, technically, that would fall under the champagne category. But see, a lot of people don't realize that...
Is it pronounced champagne?
Champagne. You got to say the G. You got to say the G in it. If it's not made in the champagne region, you shouldn't be calling it champagne.
Yeah.
We're trying... And this is what we do on Taste the World. We try to give people those small jewels. That's something that
Kobe
remember.
Beef, man.
Exactly.
I get so pissed when I guess it's,
it's American Kobe.
No, it can't be American Kobe.
I know.
That's like American.
It's a made up word.
No, but I love it when I see I tell my customers at Momo, if you see a Kobe burger and it's under $100, it's not Kobe beef.
Also, if you see a Kobe burger, well, I guess it's you got to use the animal nose to tail, but maybe that's just a waste of that that cut. Maybe it's the inappropriate use.
Mm.
It'd be like mimosa with a vintage champagne.
Yeah.
Maybe you should rethink your application.
Well, that's what, also too, people that I've, over the years working in so many restaurants and stuff, people are like, why would somebody, pay $30,000 for wine? But it's the same thing, why would somebody pay $500,000 for a watch? Well, you like watches, and you have $1 billion. Why wouldn't you buy a $500,000 watch? Or you love wine and you have $1 billion.
Right.
Why wouldn't you? It would be like, it would be like somebody saying, why would you pay $50 for a shirt? Oh, because I have thousands of dollars. $50 is nothing to me. That's why I'd pay $50 for a shirt. This shirt was free, by the way.
It looks fantastic on you.
Well, guys, thank you so much for coming in. Tell us the name of the auction house and the podcast again.
We're actually completely dedicated to our podcast right now. This is where I'm completely into the consulting world.
Oh, nice.
Just straight logistics. But Taste the World Podcast. .com August 1st.
Awesome.
First episode goes live, and
if somebody needs some wine consulting or has $30,000 in their pocket that they want to give you for one bottle of wine, they can contact you at that same address.
You can definitely get it. You can get at us through TasteTheWorldPodcast.com.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much for coming. It's so nice to talk to you guys.
Jermaine Stone, Julia Gilbert. Before we head out, I just want to say...
Stone and Gilbert Winery, 2018.
I just want to give a quick shout out to Heritage Radio Network. I know we're always trying to raise money, get some donations. Heritage Radio Network is actually a nonprofit, member-supported radio station devoted to all things food, just like we just talked about.
Is it a 501c?
It is a 501c.
That's a
C3. 501c3.
No shit. It's an actual legal, not for profit organization.
Motherfucking 501c.
Wow.
Three. Boom!
Yay!
Thank you, David. If you guys want to help support, help us keep the lights on, please go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart in the corner to donate. And do it now.
Fade out, David. Dum, dum.
Happy Sunday, guys.
Happy Sunday.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. Shine.